are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, January 7th, 2016. I'm Michael Brooks, and this is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Alexis Goldstein, financial expert, banking reform advocate, is going to be joining us to talk about what real financial reform looks like in the 21st century. We're going to take a deep dive with her, bringing back Glass-Steagall and protecting your economy from the Wall Street economy. Also, Bernie Sanders unveils his proposals for reining in the banks and breaking the banks up. Bernie Sanders also says he's more electable than Hillary Clinton. Apple has a new scheme that will waste your money and destroy the planet. And I might be reaching my breaking point with Apple if this story is true. We'll talk about that. Are Hillary's poll numbers in Iowa weaker than they appear? And it seems pretty clear that North Korea did not detonate a hydrogen bomb. Sad to say. Kidding, obviously. That's good news, but that crisis continues. That sort of low-grade crisis with North Korea continues, but it looks like without the addition of a hydrogen bomb, Syria continues in crisis and civil war as tensions continue to flare up between Iran and Saudi Arabia, both sides trading new accusations as the Middle East continues to boil over, and China's stock market, that looks really bad. They're not going to be able to carry the burden to save the global economy anymore, clearly. Get to all of that, and of course your calls and IMs on today's program. Sam's still out. He's in jury duty. It would be really amazing to sit on a jury with Sam. And I don't mean that in necessarily a good way. I think I could see at a certain point sending somebody to prison who I thought was innocent just to stop the conversation. Oh, I'm just kidding. I'm kind of surprised because I sort of thought that if you had a position in media to a certain degree, it made it sort of unlikely. But I don't know. It's an interesting process, and I'm sure Sam will have a lot to share about it when he returns. But on today's program, we'll get to a lot of really important things with Alexis Goldstein. You're seeing Hillary and Bernie releasing contrasting reform proposals. And, you know, if you look at what's happening in China and you look at the sort of the reality that we still have banks that are essentially loaded guns aimed at the global economy, these issues are not going anywhere. And it's important to talk to people who understand the real work and the real process of reform. So we're going to get to that in just one moment with Alexis Goldstein on the Majority Report. We'll be right back.
Out in the street, they call it murder. back. It in your handbag, your knapsack, it in your backpack. The smell of your girlfriend contact. Some boy not know this. Them only come around like tourists on the beach with a few club sodas. Bedtime stories and pose like them named Chuck Norris. And don't know the real hardcore, cause sandals are not back to. The thugs them we do where them got to. And won't think twice to shot to. Don't make them spot to. Unless you carry guns a lot to. A beer tough thing come at you. When trench town man stop laugh and block off traffic. Then them we learn pop off and them start trap it. We dip in file long and it a beat trap it. Police come in a jeep and them can't stop it. Some say them a playboy rabbit. Get chopped like a bad habit. Son of a da post off if you're down top it. Rastafari stands alone. Pure ghost and phantom. The youth them get blind by stardom. Now the king of kings are called. Whole man to pick me. So wave on no one if you with me. To see this operation sick me. Them suit not fit me. To win election them trick with them. Them down to nothing.
That was Damian Marley. This is the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Alexis Goldstein. She's a senior policy analyst at Americans for Financial Reform. Alexis, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me. How are you?
Sorry about that, Alexis. We missed you for just 1 second. Great to have you on.
Good to be here. Thanks.
So I want to sort of orient the conversation we're going to have. There has been in the last week, Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton have both articulated more in a more in-depth ways their proposals on Wall Street reform, their proposals on banking. We're seeing some moves in the Senate, actually a bipartisan moves for some very deep and structural reform, and in fact introducing a 21st century Glass-Steagall, which we'll talk about later. But before we get to all of that, I would like to orient the conversation with a reminder of what Dodd-Frank did. I think we see across the political spectrum, you see on the right, Dodd-Frank is this new sort of big government monstrosity that blocks the ability of community banks and small lenders and small businesses to sort of grow and innovate. Then in the sort of Obama mold, it's heralded as a great accomplishment and in a sort of abiding reform. And then I would say in the politics of people like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, and obviously this show, in fact, it did some things, but really probably not enough. So, but sort of where do you come down on that, and what are the kind of main takeaways of Dodd-Frank?
Well, Dodd-Frank is definitely a huge victory, and it's something that the banking industry, in a very coordinated way, lobbied against incredibly aggressively. Elizabeth Warren likes to talk about the armies of lobbyists that descended onto Washington to lobby against Dodd-Frank, and then they called halftime once Dodd-Frank was passed and continued to lobby to try and weaken it after it was passed. But in terms of what it did, I try to break it up into different buckets, and I think the easiest bucket to understand is the creation of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which was the brainchild of now Senator Elizabeth Warren, then, you know, law professor Elizabeth Warren. And that's essentially the only federal regulator whose sole mission it is to protect consumers from financial scams. We never before had a single regulator whose only job was to do that. And since the creation, I'm going to call it the CFPB for short, so I don't keep having to say Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. But so the CFPB has been around for about 4 years. They've returned over $11 billion to Americans who were scammed by their financial companies. So that's everything from someone who got, you know, some alleged credit score enhancement product that they never asked for from their credit card company, to people who were outright lied to about, you know, their mortgage or was illegally foreclosed on or, you know, was lied to or had a predatory loan from a for-profit college. The list is quite long. So that's one bucket.
There's a lot of innovation in the defraud people in their financial products industry.
Yes, and you can think of the CFPB as kind of like the cop on the beat looking out for you against financial scams,
right,
and financial scammers. So that's been a huge success, and I think in some ways is maybe the thing that is the biggest victory in Dodd-Frank. Another bucket is sort of reform to the mortgage market, trying to make mortgages safer and reforms to try to prevent some of the kind of bait and switch rates that people experienced during the predatory lending that led up to the financial crisis. Another bucket I like to think about in terms of an emergency room and then some preventative medicine. Mm-hmm. So Dodd-Frank established an emergency room for banks that basically outlines what happens would a bank start to fail, and it gives some new abilities to try to, you know, avoid that. And, you know, the group called the FDIC steps in. They try to sell off some assets and essentially, you know, put the bank through the ER and eventually kind of set up its funeral, to be honest. So maybe an ER is not exactly the best analogy, but, you know, they try to sort of break it up and not have to have to do any kind of a bailout. But then there's some preventative medicine, so you never have to go to the ER in the first place. And that preventative medicine is something called a living will. So basically all of the banks now have to submit to the FDIC and to the Fed, here's how you could break me up, and well, not break me up, but here's how I could fail and go through bankruptcy and not require the government to come in and bail me out.
Right.
And if the Fed and the FDIC think that, you know, that plan that they submitted is not credible, they can actually break them up and force them to sell off certain assets because they don't think, you know, they think they're still too big to fail without harming the economy. So again, I think of it as we have some preventative medicine, but then we also have this emergency room. And then the final two buckets, one of them is about what are known as derivatives, which are these financial products that you hear about a lot when we talk about the crisis. Some of them are quite risky. They're things like
to be clear, this is the meltdown of 2008 crisis. The
correct.
Derivative markets
right.
were the sort of, you know, I mean, obviously there's a little bit more complexity in this, but that's kind of the sort of ground zero of that meltdown specifically was in the derivative markets.
Right. So you might have heard the term credit default swaps, and these are sort of like insurance on a company or insurance on a financial product. So you can't take out insurance on your neighbor's house, right? Because then you would have an incentive to light your neighbor's house on fire. But you can currently take out what seems like insurance on a company or on a financial product. And so part of the problem with these credit default swaps is it seems like it created this perverse incentive for people to want, you know, the housing market to fail because they would get paid out if it did fail. So that's one of the products that are included in derivatives. There's a whole bunch more, but you also may hear about the sort of toxic subprime mortgages. Those were all bundled up into fancy financial products. So part of Dodd-Frank's...
That's a bunch of derivatives that are sort of, yeah, as you say, they're bundled together, and then they're almost... So I guess the way it worked functionally is you could take a bunch of individual bad derivatives, questionable ones, and then somehow by fusing them all together into a sort of like... WMD of bad derivatives, all of a sudden they became safe according to the credit rating agencies. And that was another major aspect of the crisis.
Yeah, the way I like to explain it so you might hear about, like if you saw The Big Short, for example, that movie, they
great
talk
movie.
About these. There were mortgage-backed securities and there were things called CDOs. But the way I like to think of them is a mortgage-backed security is take 1,000 mortgages, 10,000 mortgages, put them in a box. That's a mortgage-backed security. Mm-hmm. A CDO is you take 100 boxes of mortgage-backed securities, and probably you take the worst ones, and you put those in a box, then you have a CDO. But anyway, it's just lots of complicated packaging up of different kinds of mortgages, and then packaging those packages again, and then sometimes repackaging the packages. So, you know, it's sort of like an infinite, what is it, Escher drawing, if you've ever seen that, spiral, kind of, you go up the staircase, down the staircase, around and around.
And then somehow it just winds up with you losing your job and your savings.
Right, right. So part of Dodd-Frank said, listen, this was out of control. We had no window into what was going on. We didn't know how many people owned how many derivatives, because some derivatives actually are traded on markets, on exchanges, I should say. And so we know the volume. We know how many. We don't know who traded them, but we know how many.
Mm-hmm.
But a vast majority of them, and most of the risky ones that tank the economy, are traded what's called over-the-counter. You could think of it as like bespoke. It's the difference between like walking into a clothing store and giving a choice of like what's on the rack versus like going to a custom tailor,
right?
There's no way of knowing how many custom suits were made in a country in a given year, but you can probably figure out how many, you know, T-shirts Walmart sold of a certain kind. So Dodd-Frank said, look, we need more transparency into this market, like, and we need, you know, to push people more towards trading in a standardized way so that we can understand it, so that we can see it coming. So that was one bucket. And then the last bucket I'll mention is one that I have a particular, favor for, just because I spent so much time trying to improve it, and it's called the Volcker Rule. And if folks have ever heard of Glass-Steagall, which is the Depression-era law separating boring banking from risky casino banking, you can kind of think of the Volcker Rule as like a light version of Glass-Steagall. And the Volcker Rule basically said, hey, if you're a big bank that enjoys the backing of the government through FDIC insurance, you don't get to make bets for yourself. You don't, and that's called proprietary trading, but you can think of it as gambling.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically like, look, if the government's going to back you, fine, but you don't get to go gamble at the casino. You got to just trade for customers and make markets for customers. And so that's sort of the last bucket. So it's a lot, right? It's a
right.
lot of different things, a lot of different sort of topic areas. But that's because, you know, the financial crisis wasn't just one thing.
Right.
It was a lot of bad things that all combined into a terrible blow-up that cost, you know, 8 to 9 million people were foreclosed on. That's like the same number of people that are in Michigan. So it's like we foreclosed on the entire state of Michigan. And obviously, you know, it cost, I think, you know, trillions and trillions of dollars to the economy.
Yes, absolutely catastrophic. So we'll get into this sort of next wave of reforms that you're advocating. And I think another aspect that I want to touch on as well, which is a really interesting perspective you bring, is also the sort of, you know, the intellectual atmosphere around these policy debates, because we didn't just get into deregulation and moving towards the crisis simply through sort of the heavy influence of Wall Street and lobbyists. Obviously, that's a major part of it, and just in terms of campaign contributions and political influence. But there was also an ideological and a sort of elite policy narrative that went along with it. But before we get to that, so it seems like when you break Dodd-Frank down, there's some areas like the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which is a success. It's designed to preserve a vital function in the 21st century. It's delivering for people in real ways. Then there's other areas that are more mixed. And then maybe there are areas when we get to, specifically I want to touch on living will, which you have noted in your response, and also the Volcker Rule. And because those are the areas where we start to get to this sort of ongoing problem of too big to fail and how large these institutions can be, frankly, in a safe way for the rest of the economy. And those that defend Dodd-Frank will definitely say, well, we didn't break the banks up, but we are certainly put in the policy mechanisms to make sure that we're not on the hook to save them again. And it seems like from your answer, what's kind of interesting is that, and correct me if I'm wrong, is it true that before we even get into the next policy steps are needed, is it possible that if Dodd-Frank was getting enforced more rigorously when it came to living will and to the Volcker Rule, that already would make a real dent in too big to fail? And explain, I guess, as part of that answer, how living will and how the Volcker Rule are being enforced. Because I seen you pointed me to an exchange with Senator Warren and Janet Yellen, the head of the Fed, where, you know, Elizabeth Warren was saying you're not really the Fed is not really acting on this living will provision very strongly at all, specifically in the case of JP Morgan, but I'm sure beyond that.
Right. So let's start with the living wills. So the living wills are basically the biggest banks have to write a plan and hand it to the Fed and hand it to the FDIC. And the FDIC is the organization that insures deposits, right? So if your bank goes belly up, they're the organization that helps make sure that that money that was in your checking account, you get it back.
Mm-hmm.
Important regulator.
Communist.
So
that's what I hear.
Been around for a long time.
I feel like doing my Ben Carson impression so badly right now, but I will. It's socialism. Okay, go ahead.
We can bring him back later, maybe. So the banks write these, you know, living wills, and they say, okay, here's how I could go bankrupt without the government having to save me. And then there are all of these steps that are supposed to happen after they submit it, and it's all there in Dodd-Frank. And so the Fed and the FDIC review it, and if they have problems, then the banks can resubmit it. If they resubmit it and there's still problems, you know, they can go back and forth and have an iteration, but eventually, you know, if the plans are not credible, the Fed and the FDIC can say to them, hey, you need to sell some stuff off because you're too risky. And, you know, essentially they can say, you need to break yourself up and here's how we suggest that you do that. And they can add some other restrictions. So the exchange between Senator Elizabeth Warren and the Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen was Elizabeth Warren basically saying that, like, you know, we told you in Dodd-Frank that if a bank's plan wasn't credible, that you were to take steps to make sure that the banks were safer. And Janet Yellen basically says, well, it's an iterative process, and, you know, they've given us their first plan, and we're trying to help them see different ways that they can, you know,
I used that line when I was late turning in my thesis in college. I said
exactly.
It was an iterative process. Yeah,
right.
It got me a couple extra days.
She says, you know, we're trying to give them an opportunity to address the obstacles to, you know, resolving themselves under bankruptcy. But basically, like, the, you know, what she's actually saying is they're not there yet, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Elizabeth Warren presses her and says, okay, if they're not there yet, why aren't you moving on? Why do you keep whispering in their ear, here's how you can improve, here's how you can pass the test, right? You failed the test, here's how you can pass the test. You failed the test again, here's how you can pass the test. And to be fair, no one's actually said that they failed the test, but no one said that they passed the test either. And so it's sort of a question of, could they be doing more? Elizabeth Warren is saying absolutely they could. I certainly personally think that they could be doing more. So that's one piece of it. The second piece of it is the Volcker Rule piece of it. And Americans for Financial Reform, where I work, has written a letter to the regulators, our policy director, Marcus Stanley, looked at the data of trading that banks have done since the Volcker Rule has gone into effect. And the Volcker Rule went into effect finally last year in July, but the banks knew it was coming for a really long time. And one of the things that people thought the Volcker Rule would do is it might change the levels of trading, right? Because Volcker says, again, you can't do the riskiest kind of gambling if you want to be backed by the government through FDIC insurance. And so we should see some change in the kinds of trading that they're doing, right? So they're not doing this, it's called proprietary trading, it's gambling essentially, but maybe, you know, they have more trading in another part of the bank. So we should see some change. But Marcus Stanley found that there has not been a change to either to trading revenue since the Volcker Rule went into effect. So that leads us to a question. Okay, has there not been a change because it's shifted to a different part of the bank? Or has there not been a change because the Volcker Rule isn't actually being followed right now? So we're calling on more transparency so we can try to figure that out. And we, you know, outlined a series of suggestions of different kinds of metrics that they could provide us so that the public could, you know, act and try to, you know, as a second level of accountability. But sort of there's an open question as to whether or not the Volcker Rule is actually being enforced and implemented right now, because we haven't seen really a change in the levels of trading at some of the biggest banks, which, again, we don't know if that means, that might mean that the kinds of trading has just shifted to different parts that are allowed, but it could also, you know, it could also mean something worse. So we just don't know, and we need more information to know. And just to circle back to the living wills one,
mm-hmm.
That's another problem with the living wills is transparency.
Right.
Is Elizabeth Warren pointed this out when she was questioning Chair Yellen. She said, Chair Yellen said, oh, you know, J.P. Morgan submitted a 10,000-page living will plan to us. And Elizabeth Warren says, well, that's interesting. The public gets 35 pages. Why are we only, you know, and I get it, you know, maybe some of the stuff needs to be secret, but that's a big difference. 35 pages versus 10,000 pages? It seems like the public could see a little bit more than 35 pages. So there's I think, an issue with transparency here. And because there's an issue with transparency, it's hard to know if this stuff is actually working.
Right. And I mean, and that is also goes back to the meltdown in terms of information and transparency about the process. And we talked about it with regards to derivatives, but all of these areas. So that's an ongoing problem. And even going back to the sort of deregulation era, there still was questions of, well, what was on the books and what was being followed and what was being enforced and not being enforced. So those problems are clearly ongoing from just a sort of operational and regulatory standpoint. Let's, you know, Hillary Clinton, we'll just touch briefly on the presidential candidates. I mean, in the Democratic primary, Hillary Clinton has sort of advocated, it seems to me, kind of a Dodd-Frank plus kind of approach. And Bernie Sanders is saying he'll go in and break up the banks, period, and he'll also restore Glass-Steagall, which we'll certainly talk about in a minute as well, because I know you're doing a lot of work on that specific policy, and there is a version of it in the Senate. But the other thing that Bernie Sanders has also been sort of campaigning on and talking about is the need for some criminal culpability and a criminal accountability in Wall Street. Now, you know, in some respects, functionally, this is like, it's good politics. I don't really know kind of practically what that looks like now. But it seems to me that another aspect of the fallout of this crisis and too big to fail in general is not just, you know, the sort of emotional satisfaction of seeing somebody who may be engaged in illegal or certainly unethical behavior being criminally accountable. But it's also the, you know, the phrase's moral hazard that's created by no accountability in that way. And I guess my question is that the sort of the next stage that's needed? And I know I'm connecting breaking up the banks with criminal accountability, and obviously you can distinguish those two things. But is there this sort of more kind of structural, deeply reformist response that's needed to really clean up the system now? I mean, that seems to sort of be what the dividing line is in some respects in the current debate, that very few people, I guess, other than, you know, some on the right, although to be really fair, not all on the right, are sort of saying, you know, just sort of get rid of regulation and sort of go back to the casino days. But it seems that the debate has shifted to, do we work on this sort of incrementalism and the steady progress of Dodd-Frank and maybe clean up around the edges? Or was this big reform movement that didn't happen in 2008 and it's still needed and we still need to get there?
Well, I think we need to do both is the answer. I mean, I think we need to take Dodd-Frank and stretch it to its absolute limit. And I think we also need new legislation. And then, you know, of course, we need a movement of people that are going to make sure that both of those two things happen, right? Because I think, you know, no matter who it is, politicians need public accountability.
Right.
I think that part of the problem with the sort of criminal prosecutions, right, because if you compare this 2008 financial crisis to the savings and loan crisis, a 1,000 bankers went to jail. Over 1,000 bankers went to jail. And
that was in the 1980s, you know, for everybody, savings and loans, yeah.
And we heard, I think almost inadvertently in a way, from Eric Holder, who sort of made comments kind of saying, he didn't actually use the phrase too big to jail, but sort of implying that the fact that these firms were so large, it was hard to hold them accountable. He gave a speech talking about how, you know, responsibility is very diffuse among these firms. But it just seems like it's sort of like a chicken and an egg problem, right? Do you get to breaking up the banks with criminal prosecutions, or do you break up the banks so you can get criminal prosecutions?
Mm.
And I think it's you got to start with making these banks less powerful, right? Because I think it's correct that they continue to run Washington, D.C. in many ways. Citigroup is probably a prime example because they received nearly $500 billion if you add up all of their government assistance. So not just the bailout, but all of the sort of, you know, easy loans that they got from the Fed while things were rocky. It's almost $500 billion. So you would think that that would hurt your credibility, right? You think after that, if Citigroup went to D.C. and said, hey, we have a great idea for a new bill, Congress would say, I don't think I'm going to listen to you this time. But that's not
you
what
might say you guys have
all.
A lot of chutzpah, and I always listen to chutzpah.
You would hope, but in 2014, it was reported by the New York Times that Citigroup wrote a law, like they literally drafted it, and then it got passed through the House, and then it got tucked into a year-end spending bill, and it got signed into law. And so we have Citigroup, you know, the biggest recipient of money from both the Fed and the bailout, writing our laws. So in some ways, I would maybe say that I think we need to make the bank smaller in order to have more criminal accountability, because I think that they are too big to fail. And in some ways, I think there's a perception that they're too big to jail. And so it's crazy how much this parallels the Great Depression. Like before, in the years before the Great Depression, someone who was later a Supreme Court justice, a guy named Louis Brandeis, wrote this book called Our Financial Oligopoly. And his arch nemesis was J.P. Morgan. And, you know, J.P. Morgan existed.
The names
bank,
are still
the
same
the
sometimes. Huh?
Yeah, so the names are still the same. So he writes this book. It gets a lot of attention. Then the Great Depression happens for much of the same reasons that the 2008 financial crisis happened, which is that banks were pushing crappy products on people. They didn't happen to be mortgages. They were crappy stocks that they were, like, pumping and dumping. So they passed Glass-Steagall specifically to address these problems. And, you know, J.P. Morgan actually blames Louis Brandeis' book. They think he's the reason that it got passed in the first place.
Right.
So J.P. Morgan gets split up into J.P. Morgan and Morgan Stanley, you know, and then fast forward decades later, that law, Glass-Steagall, gets rolled back, you know, and J.P. Morgan is bigger than ever, even though it got split up, you know, in the 1930s. And so in some ways, it's like we're repeating history.
Right.
But one of the arguments Brandeis makes, and this is why I'm bringing it up, is that he called them the money trust, but basically the idea was that they controlled Congress because they were so big and so powerful. So I think the criminal accountability will come if we can, you know, ensure that the regulators, you know, follow Dodd-Frank. You know, perhaps, you know, let's throw some new legislation in as well. Let's limit the size of these banks that will limit their influence. And then, you know, maybe we'll actually see some more prosecutions. There have been some, but, you know, they've been pretty minor.
Yeah, it's an interdependent.
We've seen a lot of settlements, but not a lot of prosecutions.
Right, which, again, if you look at the kind of balance sheets, you can kind of pretty quickly sort of see the settlements as just the sort of cost of doing business. And I want to just add as an addendum, one of the times that Eric Holder at least sort of made comments to the effect of, you know, maybe there are people that are too big to jail, institutions that are sort of too complex to approach criminally, was with regard to HSBC. And some of the investigations around HSBC were not, I mean, we're not even talking about, you know, financial fraud and all of the other sort of main things we talk about. With HSBC specifically, they were asking, well, why aren't they getting criminally prosecuted for being involved in admittedly in money laundering for drug cartels and terrorist organizations? I mean, that's publicly documented, including in, you know, Senate reports of HSBC's behavior. So the extent to which the power of these institutions and the utter lack of accountability is obviously very structural and goes far beyond even, you know, pushing crappy derivatives and you know, and defrauding investors. So, but back to your point.
Can I jump in though?
Yeah, please,
quickly.
Go ahead.
Because I think it's important that people recognize the victories too, because it's easy to get depressed, right?
Oh, okay.
We talk about this.
Yeah.
And so the CFPB is, I think, an important bright spot to highlight because
Definitely. They
have been going after financial companies. And they have, as I mentioned before, returned over $11 billion to over 25 million people who were scammed by their financial companies. And maybe part of that is because they're new, right, and they're novel, and they have this unique mission. But it's not, I just don't want people to get too depressed listening to this.
Oh, no.
There are absolutely really important good things that are happening. And if you look at the list of, they put out, you know, press statements every time they do an enforcement action, but they come quite a lot. So if you need a boost, go to consumerfinance.gov every now and then and take a look at what the CFPB is doing.
Add that to your like morning like uplifting material list. I like that. Somebody's
yeah,
like,
and I should say that their success has gained them so many enemies. Just this week, there's a new AstroTurf group. They call themselves USA Consumers on Twitter, but they're just Politico did a story saying that, you know, the address that they have listed points back to an address associated with groups linked to the Kochs.
Sure.
So it appears to be an AstroTurf group, but they're attacking the CFPB. Lots of politicians attack the CFPB all the time, and it's because they're working. So it's not all doom and gloom.
No, it's an incredible success. And anytime you see a group with a name like that, or like Americans for a Brighter Future or something, you usually have to, you know, it's not for a brighter future. But let's go to something else that's in process, but is also really positive, and I want you to touch on before we wrap up, which is that, and this is something you've been working on a lot, and it's a bill that's currently in the Senate. It's co-sponsored by Elizabeth Warren, John McCain, Maria Cantwell, who's from Washington, and who's also a Democrat like Warren. McCain's obviously a Republican. Angus King, who is an independent from Maine, and it's a 21st century Glass-Steagall. It's tremendously positive that this bill has that sort of range of support in the Senate. That, along with, you know, obviously Bernie Sanders is pushing for that really strongly. So this bill is in the center of debate. It's a real thing. I mean, and we should also remind everybody, too, that we were just talking about the great success of the Consumer Financial Protection Agency. That, you know, that was not something that you would necessarily put money on passing when it was first floated. But because of grassroots support and because of really effective organizing, you know, it got in. So Glass-Steagall can happen as well. So why don't you tell us about that and what the stakes are of that fight and where it stands now?
Sure. So there's two additional co-sponsors in addition to all the ones that you mentioned. There's also Tammy Baldwin and Sheldon Whitehouse.
Okay.
But what's, as you mentioned, what's so interesting about this is it's coming up in the presidential debates. And anytime, you know, you have a big media spotlight on something, that drastically increases people's knowledge about it, increases the chances of things moving, and it helps kind of build this momentum. And so the fact, you know, and this is why primaries are so important, right, is because we get to have debates like this about whether or not Glass-Steagall is an important reform. I believe that Glass-Steagall would be a very important reform. It needs to be updated. That's what this bill does. Glass-Steagall wasn't killed by a single, you know, it wasn't like one day that killed it, although, you know, a lot of people point to this 1999 date. It was actually like a death by a thousand cuts. And so there's a bunch of things that need to happen to reinstate this separation, which is what this bill does, separating the risky casino banking from the boring, what's called commercial banking that you probably think of when you think of banking, savings accounts, mortgages, checking accounts. And the way that this has come up in the presidential debate is people are trying to diagnose, well, what caused the crisis? And did, you know, repealing Glass-Steagall and getting rid of this separation of these banks, was that a part of the crisis or not? And I would absolutely argue that it was.
Mm-hmm.
We saw failures of investment banks, which are the casino sort of style of banking, when Glass-Steagall was still in place, and they failed and they did not ruin the rest of the economy. The risk didn't spread to the rest of the financial system. They were able to fail or be bought without, you know, huge problems happening. The two firms I'm thinking about are Drexel Burnham and Salomon. After Glass-Steagall is gone, you have the failure of Bear Stearns, which was an investment bank. You have the failure of Lehman. And the failure of Lehman didn't cause the crisis. The failure of Lehman exposed the crisis.
Mm.
And the failure of Lehman caused all of this risk to spread to all of these other banks who had the same positions as Lehman, the same crappy mortgage-backed securities we were talking about earlier. And it just caused this horrible cascading effect. The other thing is it helps with what we were talking about before about political capture and the banks wielding too much influence. Separating investment banking, again, that's the casino kind of banking, from the boring commercial banking, it creates competition. right? Because a boring bank has different interests than an investment bank. And I used to work at an investment bank. I worked at Morgan Stanley. I worked there before the crisis. And I remember my boss telling me, we don't advertise. We don't need to advertise. We're a boutique. You know, we have these fancy hoity-toity clients.
Right.
And they know us and we know them. And since the financial crisis, all of these banks do advertise. So
yeah.
It's very funny. But there was a very different culture. And with that different culture, you had this sort of natural competition. And so there was some checks and balances. And there wasn't just, you know, the government separation, I think, was enough for a while. But I think it would be good to have a combined approach now, right? You can
Absolutely,
have
yeah.
what we have in Dodd-Frank. And then, you know, if you break up these banks, if you separate the two kinds of banking, they'll start competing with each other when it comes to lobbying instead of working as they do now in complete unison, in lockstep. And so it's just this, you know, giant army of lobbyists coming to D.C. saying the same thing. So that's part of the reasons why I think that this is important and why, as a bank dork, I am so excited to hear this debate happening as the presidential, you know, race goes on. I wouldn't have predicted it, to be honest, if you asked me, say, 5 years ago that they would be debating this in the presidential election.
We should all do more to help bank dorks have joy in their lives. And so as a final question, and you've also, we've sort of gotten around it when we talk about the capture of the legislative process and just the sort of tremendous raw outsized power that financial institutions have. But the other aspect that, you know, you've spoken really, really effectively about is also just the social networks, the intellectual assumptions, the ideological assumptions that sort of back that conformity. It's kind of like the cultural and ideological corollary of all the money and all of the special interest lobbying. And I'm just wondering, as part of this positive note and as part of what we're seeing in the presidential campaign, and we're seeing this new push in the Senate, is that aspect of how much of that aspect is changing in the debate and in Washington specifically as well? That the default assumptions about, you know, deregulation and all of that are really being called into question. I mean, obviously they are. We wouldn't be having this debate, certainly in the primaries to begin with. But, you know, to what extent, how deep is that sort of change conversation happening?
Well, I think you might think it was smaller than it actually is, because mm-hmm. you don't hear so much of this. Sometimes you do, but coming from, say, the Republican debates. But mm-hmm. if you look at the actual polling data, and the organization I work at, Americans for Financial Reform, has done polling on this. It is a bipartisan issue. Two-thirds of Americans think that across party lines, Republican, Democrat, doesn't matter, think that there should be more regulation on the banks, not less. And when you describe to them what the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau does, because a lot of people haven't heard of it, again, across party lines, people think it's a good idea. So I think that's part of the reason why you know, maybe certain politicians may not want to talk about it too much, because it's very unpopular to advocate for things that help the biggest banks. But it's actually, you know, this isn't a partisan issue. People pretty much agree on this. And so I think that that gives me a lot of optimism. And that's been true. It was obviously true after the financial crisis, but we've done polling on this very recently. It's still true. So I think that this is still something in the American people's mind, that this is unfinished. And so, you know, that's part of what I do every day of my job, is we work to try to finish, you know, the unfinished business of financial reform and make sure that we have a safer financial system that works for everybody. But, you know, Republicans, Democrats, it doesn't seem to matter. People want that across the board.
Absolutely. Alexis Goldstein, I really appreciate your time today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Okay, folks. We are going to get to the fun half, where we will take your calls. We will take your IMs. The number is 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. I'll call into the phone lines in a minute. We have a lot of sound for you. And I'm like pre-annoyed at this Apple story. If this Apple story is true, it might be the end of the road for me with Apple, at least with the iPhone. So we'll get to that. And yeah, There's a ton of sound. There's a lot to get to. We will have a very fun, fun half. Become a member of the Majority Report today. You can do it at majority.fm/become a member. Less than a cup of coffee a day. Support independent, real independent media. Less than a cup of coffee a day. It's what allows all of this to happen. Buy your stuff on Amazon. If you use Amazon, use our link. It's at the bottom of our homepage. You click on it. Buy your things on Amazon. It makes absolutely no difference to you, but a little tiny sliver gets to us. Write us a review on iTunes. Subscribe to us on iTunes, even if you're a member. It helps with the algorithm. Subscribe to us on YouTube, Sam Cedar. That's the name of the channel on YouTube. Like us on Facebook. We post stuff there pretty regularly. Follow us on Twitter at majority.fm. And that's about it. I hope everybody has a great day and see you in the fun half.